in what this world,
I mean, he must.
It's in this world that one thing must never do. If you sit in a cafe and you hear an anti-Protean accent, you must never by accident ask an Australian whether they are from New Zealand or a New Zealander whether they're from Australia. They will be extremely upset.
Particularly the latter.
And the same applies in the context of today's lecture. You must never conclude Turku with Artu, I am told. One is English University in Finland, and the other one, the leading international law place in Estonia. And of course, we are particularly pleased to have Lauri back, because all good things in the world of international law have at some stage been in Cambridge. And Lauri was a visiting fellow here and a great friend of the center and the faculty of law. He is one of them who sits at the fulcrum of the newly emerging world order or disorder. We had one of his colleagues working here, Tina Payuns, who is now the professor, professor in another university in Tallinn. And she started to obtain her black belt in karate to ensure that in this new world order, Estonia would retain its independence. And she's actually very good. So if I was Mr. Putin, I would think about it twice. So it is a region that has attracted a great deal of interest. Cambridge started a center for some years ago when people thought a little bit exotic. And now it's the place where many things are happening, given that this is seen as, in a way, in the area of confrontation that may yet be come. Russian interests have been revived significantly in the world since the 24th February of 2022. And your first book on Russia and international law came out in 2015, which is a year after Crimea, which was 2014, the acquisition, forcible acquisition of Crimea. And your second book came out last year, which is this one, which is a fabulous book, which raises really quite an interesting tension or question. You mentioned in your book that there's a difference between being an empire, being imperial, and being an imperialist. And of course, we know that Russia, the Tsar, was an empire, but used to portray itself under the Soviet Union times as the champion of anti-imperialism. That all those who sought national liberation would be supported by the Soviet Union. And now we see that Russia returns possibly to being the leading imperialist power, at least in relation to its own region, something the US is trying to copy maybe at some other region at the moment. So it is really an extremely timely book you've written to trace the intellectual agenda of imperialism, imperial continuity in international law. So I'm particularly pleased to hand over the floor to you, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Weller. Thank you, Mark, for this kind introduction. And it's always a special moment for an international lawyer to speak in this hall because of its history and also a book about a book project that is in many ways about history. And I think the crux of my message is perhaps mental maps. I remember when this 22 happened, February 2022, then Ukrainians started to write that they have not been on the mental maps of many people. There was this whole nation, 40 plus million, but actually, you know, many people didn't know too much about it or about its history or about what kind of place it is. And one can extend that to some extent about Russia. It's considering the size of this country, considering what it can do, what kind of upheaval it can create in world politics. You know, we have to ask, what is the, how much do we know about Russia's trajectory in international law? And well, the answers vary. Probably different people know different things, but I think language always is one of the obstacles, you know, in this West European setting. International lawyers speak English and French. Perhaps some would know, you know, German and so on. But it's not that this you know, preoccupation with let's say sources also in Russian language are somehow so central to what we do. And I was thinking to use also as visuals a little bit stamps, because when I grew up in late Soviet Union, my father was collecting stamps. He was had one pen friend in Eastern Germany and the other one in Czechoslovakia. With him, he wrote in Esperanto, and then they would exchange stamps. You know, this was my first window to the world, not also the history. All those British colonies with very exotic names, they all issued their own stamps, and you can see, you can learn lots about stamps. You know, they are the representation. A country is sending. They are those little propaganda posters. Country is telling us something. I don't think there is a concilium of international lawyers when they issue stamp, but some sort of conciliums there do exist, and then in that sense, you know, it's not formally of source a source of international law stamps. When I last time checked the ICJ statute, but sometimes it can send us or kind of can tell us something about how the country wants to see us, its world events. So that is a 23 stamp from Russia about Catherine II, basically, annexed Crimea and other regions at Azov and Black Sea. And of course, so it's fascinating that what is taken from here is an event from the late 18th century. There is no stamp repeating, for example, the Budapest Memorandum in 1994, in which Russia said that borders are guaranteed the way they, or there was assurances were given. Ukraine gave away nuclear weapons, or that there was also a bilateral border treaty between Russia and Ukraine from February 2003, once again, accepted those 91 borders. Another recent stamp. This was a peace treaty between the Russian and Ottoman empires. I mean, there was a whole range of wars between Russia and the Ottoman Empire in the 19th and 18th centuries, which the Russian Empire expanded to the south, and it was a very interesting aspect of this civilized and uncivilized in the history of international law, because of course the Russian Empire could use this argument that they were part of the civilized as the European Christian, and they argued that the Ottoman Empire was not. So this was further legitimation for expansion. Or another treaty already from the Baltic Sea region. This is the peace treaty of Neustadt or Uusikaupunki. The image is taken from the Peterhof Castle near St. Petersburg. So the lion is Sweden. The lion's jaws are, you know, the hero will break it open and conquer some new territory there, because St. Petersburg was actually, as you know, created on the territory conquered through that war. And this great Nordic war is actually when Russian historiography of international law starts its kind of counting or interaction with international law, the first writing arguably using international law from Russia is from a diplomat in the government of Peter the Great, the Tsar. A discourse concerning the just causes of the war between Sweden and Russia. But what is fascinating about it is that ultimately it's from the perspective of today's international lawyers, the key argument there is a justification why previous treaties could be terminated, could be violated. So it's not just about the war, it's actually about treaties, because Sweden's propaganda was saying that, look what they do, we had those beautiful treaties, and they are violating it now. They are immoral, they are, you know. And then, so the challenge for Shafirov is to basically give some sort of justification why that was all right. So all the kind of register is used there, like Moscovy concluding the previous treaties when it was weak. The previous Tsar, Boris Godunov, was weak. There were, you know, Sweden too didn't always behave correctly. All the kind of things we would also actually see in some contemporary context of international legal arguments as well. In the history of international law of treaties, one central moment in time was 1871, when Europe debated about what does actually pacta sunt servanda mean in the law of treaties. And the context was that Russia had been defeated in the Crimean War of 1853-1856, and a peace treaty had been imposed on Russia, Paris Peace Treaty, which prohibited Russia to have navy in the Black Sea, as well as fortifications on the northern shore of the Black Sea. Now, 1870, the Prussian-French War breaks out, and this gentleman here was born in Estonia, in Haapsalu, Foreign Minister Gortsakov. He's making a proclamation saying that Russia puts its navy back to the Black Sea. So that becomes a kind of question of European order, because the wider question that irritates the other great powers, including this country here, was, you know, can you unilaterally change the clauses of a previous treaty, or what is necessary for that? So that is the famous London Conference and London Proclamation from 1871, where this matter gets discussed, and it adopts the principle that is still, I think, more or less, you know, what international law says today, which is that states cannot unilaterally abandon previous treaties. At the same time, of course, in terms of realpolitik, Russia's navy gets to be in the Black Sea. Very interesting lesson. A general kind of admonition, one cannot do that, but in a way they can. And that is a very interesting aspect. I've been all my life fascinated by Fyodorovich Martens, or Friedrich Martens, who was the foremost Tsarist Russian international lawyer, and he was born in Pärnu, in today's Estonia, and spent his childhood there. And in his work, one can see this kind of late 19th century imperial thought about treaties. First of all, he thought that treaties were central. He was someone who edited the 15-volume collection of Russia's treaties with other European great powers, introducing with each significant treaty, the history and politics of those treaties. But on the level of ideas, he said that don't put too much faith in pacta sunt servanda. It's basically what is the real rule of international relations is this clausula rebus sic stantibus, or fundamental change of circumstances. So he's a proponent of that. He says that Prussia behaved correctly in this 1870-71 incident. And he says that, well, just accept this is how things are. This is how international law works. Great power will terminate its previous agreements or will kind of change it unilaterally if it can. If you talk about with Germans about the history of Clausula Rebus Sixtantibus, everybody knows, of course, the book by Erich Kaufmann from before World War I, Clausula Rebus Sixtantibus und das Wesen des Völkerrechts, or the nature of international law. And they think it's a kind of German invention of revisionism, of this imperialism to justify unilateral ending of treaties. But it's when you read the Kaufmann book, the main cases he refers to is Tsarist Russia. So in that sense, it's also a migration of ideas, the transfer of ideas. It was not only that particular case, but another case related to port of Batumi in today's Georgia, then back then part of Tsarist Russia, then when Russia unilaterally ended its kind of Porto Franco status. And Russia even went to the first Hague Peace Conference in 1899, actually with this idea that we can make those agreements as long as everyone understands that, of course, agreements can also be changed unilaterally, terminated unilaterally. So this is in the nature of peace treaties. And now I come perhaps to the next period in Russia's history, which is the Soviet Union. When I walked today to the Lauterbach Center, I saw there was a poster by Revolutionary Communist Party, and it said, "Down with the war criminals, fight imperialism, join our party today." And of course, the big question is, what is imperialism? How do we define it? Lenin said that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism, and that has proven quite a successful concept, in the sense that I think people have, you know, and in that sense, the Soviet Union, Soviet Russia, they talked about themselves as they are the foremost power fighting imperialism. Imperialists were the Western nations. One famous manifestation of that were Soviet-Russian treaties with, let's say, at that time it was said Oriental power. So this is a stamp celebrating the treaty with Afghanistan from actually 1919. And the Soviets put heavily their own discourse into those treaties, into their preamble. So they were also political documents. They were saying that we are now all fighting against imperialism. By the way, some of those treaties are actually tricky, whether they did so because, for example, the treaty with Persia, it talked about this common interest to fight against imperialism, but it also gave rights to Soviet Russia to introduce its military forces in Iran or in Persia when certain conditions are fulfilled, and that actually also happened during World War II based on those treaties. In any case, you have, these are stamps, both Soviet and Russian stamps, celebrating the famous 1960 UN declaration on the independence of colonial countries and peoples. And basically, the whole discourse in Russia about Russia is that, well, the country did not have colonies, therefore it was entitled to somehow criticize the West European empires, for instance, and it actually continues until today in the General Assembly. It's always Russia who initiates, or is one of the initiators of the resolutions who talk about colonialism. At the same time, I, in terms of method, one thing that I looked in my research were Soviet legal periodicals from the 1960s. And especially at the time of those UN debates, there is like a double discourse in Russia. So on the one hand, the Soviet leaders, they are saying in the UN, look, Russia solved the issue of imperialism with the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. You guys didn't do it as well. But in the Soviet journals, such as Sovetskoe Gosudarstvo i Pravo, or Soviet State and Law, there is very strongly this message that smaller peoples of the Soviet Union have to be happy that they are so lucky that they got in contact with the more developed people. So let's keep it that way. So there is a kind of different messaging. But back to treaties. Although there was this change in the official discourse that from 1917 onwards, Soviet Russia is anti-imperialist power. Actually, in the conceptualization of treaties, very, very little changes in the interwar period. For example, both leading international law scholars in Soviet Russia in the interwar period, Yevgeny Korovin and Yevgeny Pashukhanis, but especially Pashukhanis in the 1930s, they have a completely realist take on nature of treaties. They would say that, well, of course, great powers, shape those treaties according to their interests, and the socialist power has particular reasons to do so because it also has the interests of proletariat in mind. And that creates this, so there is a clear continuity. Martens, the imperialist, Tsarist international lawyer, is essentially telling the same thing about treaties as are saying those Soviet international lawyers during the 1920s and 30s. Also, I think Russia's history demonstrates that when we talk about treaties and countries' national interests, it's not just some fancy multilateral treaties that are most important, because countries' territory can be defined through treaties. In fact, Russian Empire expands a lot with the use of treaties. Let's say Georgia in the early 19th century, initially 1783, it becomes a protectorate, which is made by a treaty of Georgievsk, and then it soon gets annexed. But treaty is basically a central element for the empire. So I think this the discourse about treaties, both for Tsarist Russia as well as Soviet Union, is not something abstract. Let's see what is our preferred international law, but it's got very, very much related to what happens to the empire. It reflects those interests of the empire. And as a result, you have this, that the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s very, very generously concludes all kinds of treaties defining aggression, non-aggression pacts, regionally, bilaterally. And they always, after the Soviet Union gets accepted to the League of Nations in 1934, they are basically making the speech that, look, we are always a step ahead of everyone in terms of treaties, in terms of their progressiveness. And then these are stamps, the liberation of brotherly peoples of Western Ukraine and Western Belarus. And this is really the central debate between also today's Russia and let's say countries like Poland and the states, probably Finland, about the origins of World War II. So basically, in many ways, we have for many decades heard the story how 1st September 1939 is aggression, but 17th September 1939 it's, as the stamps say, liberation. But basically something else than what the Nazis did. I think officially the Russian state with Putin even today holds to this version, because it's so strongly linked to this national narrative and probably interest about where we all come from. Okay, so basically, to wrap up on treaties, I realize that even that there are in the Russian scholarship of international law, even after 2014 with Crimea and after 2022, this argument of fundamental change of circumstances comes up, because there is this realization that, well, probably Russia has promised in the past through those treaties and agreements things that it has now acted contrarily to. And then this is again the revival of this argument. And that is, of course, I would say worrisome in the sense that during this UN period, including in the Vienna Convention on International Law treaties, we kind of have thought we have settled those things. We have thought that you cannot unilaterally somehow terminate a significant, geopolitically significant treaty, but in a way, Russia is now trying out whether you can or whether you can't. Will they accept it or not? So the other interesting theme which I have found is this whole debate about state continuity or state succession. I think only gourmets of international law are into that literature, that part of literature. You know, what exactly is state continuity? What is state succession? But somehow the conceptual core idea is that these terms are somehow opposites, almost analytically, in the sense that in the case of state continuity, the previous state continues as subject of international law, even though there are some changes. And with state succession, somehow there is some sort of inheritance between states that are not the same state. But I have bad news here. In Russia's case, it's all very messed up. Basically, it's a kind of part of international law where everybody can argue anything. So it's not very easy to say whether. So basically, I think what Russia has adopted is the concept of flexible state continuity, in the sense that, well, based on basically interest, based on necessity, and there have been two phases of that debate. One was in the 1920s, in the 1930s, 1940s, when the Soviet scholars had to answer the question, is Soviet Russia, is the Soviet Union the same state as Tsarist Russia or not? And of course, the second round of the same debate is the post-Soviet Russian Federation the same state as Soviet Union? And both concepts are represented, but I think some sort of idea of state continuity always comes through. But why do I call it flexible? Because, well, it has been used flexibly. So, for example, Soviet scholars said that we are the same state as Tsarist Russia, but that does not mean that Soviet Russia has to pay Tsarist Russia's debts, for instance. And one particular argument was also special nature of international law in socialist countries. So if there was no better argument could be made, then the same concept would give a different meaning in a socialist country. That is literally what these Soviet scholars writing about state succession and state continuity say in the end of their argument, that look, maybe in your country it's kind of argumentation, it's not possible. But it's possible here because, you know, we are representing a higher stage of societal evolution. So in that sense, and the same flexibility then after the new Russian Federation, because now it is necessary to abandon certain Soviet solutions. Now we hear that Soviet drawing of borders or the Soviet reliance on self-determination was a bad idea. So these can also be state continuity, but with the possibility to revise those things. Or again, going back to these secret protocols of this Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, in December 1989, I think the Soviet Parliament adopted the resolution calling that null and void these secret protocols. Now I read a book by a leading Russian scholar which argues that this declaration was null and void. So it's very interesting. You can also sometimes get in the Russian current Russian scholarship this idea that from the perspective of constitutional law, the very very dissolution of Soviet Union was done in an anti-constitutional way, which, of course, if you then approach it from that kind of continuity, you know, almost gives you the moral right to start restoring it or something, because, you know, we should not let illegal things happen, right? So in the end, to wrap it up on a, with a stamp, it just says 1,150 years of Russian statehood. And that, of course, includes the Kievan Rus. So that if you know, you know, if that is your, if you, that is your idea, if that is how you learn your history, well, that's that, then this is part of your body, right? So that's how you feel it. But then, you know, it doesn't matter that the Bolsheviks killed the last Tsar and his family, so they're also the Soviet Union needs to be celebrated too. So this is the 100 years of the formation of the Soviet Union. So there was this fascinating period from the perspective of constitutional law as well, between the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the formal formation of the Soviet Union on December 30, 1922. So the later on in the Soviet Union, there were a little bit disagreements between scholars, jurists from the center and the periphery about what were those constituent republics in the years between 1917 and 1922. Were they entirely independent states that then came back together? Or, as scholars from Moscow tended to argue, that they never got really, really independent, that it was always a federation. And somehow, in the end, this vision is still very strongly that, and as we heard from Professor Rubella as well, Russia is, of course, not alone in that. So in this sense, imperial vision for international law, they are not dead. You know, if only we could go back to this international law where great leaders of great countries meet, and somehow they will figure it out. They will, you know, somehow maybe divide the world or you know, agree what belongs to whom. By the way, there was a fascinating debate during the Cold War. The Soviet scholars were really furious when the Cold War broke out. Then a lot of Soviet international law writing was about those agreements of Yalta and Potsdam. And the Soviets then were arguing that these are real agreements of international law, and the Americans and the British have now started to violate those. Because it didn't matter that some of those agreements were oral. You know, but when Stalin talked about something in Yalta and they nodded, you better stick to it. And the empire. So these are stamps from already 2000s, and they celebrate how different regions joined Russia. There are some historical inaccuracies there, so. But what is often characteristic to those is that this discourse emphasizes that it always happened voluntarily. They came and they asked to be joined. In fact, last November, when I was teaching in Kyrgyzstan's capital city of Bishkek, there's a huge column from 20 years ago which says that 100 years from the voluntary joining of this Kyrgyzstan territory with the Russian Empire, and then you zoom in, you see what happened, then, you know, it's not always that voluntary. Now, there are wars and there are, you know, alliances and treaties, and these treaties are broken. But I guess that's also how successful empires operate, in the sense that it doesn't, what is true in those matters? What matters is the narrative that is told, what kind of monument you can put up. If everybody sees a monument or a stamp that says that the unification was voluntary, then, you know, what else do we know? Anyway, there are more of this stuff, more of these continuities, more of these examples based on the history in that study that recently came out. And I thank you for your attention. In case you have questions or comments, I would be glad.